I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners, on this edition of the program. Last week, the president of Haiti was assassinated. And although details are still emerging, it appears that the culprits were Colombians hired by a private security firm based out of Miami, Florida. With these specific details in mind, the assassination appears to raise the specter of a phenomena that has become widely popular since the launch of the War on Terror, namely the privatization of security, that is to say, the outsourcing of security work to private mercenary armies, like, as an example, Blackwater. Joining us to discuss all of this and much more is returning guest Kelly Vlahos, who recently penned a piece for the Quincy Institute's Responsible Statecraft publication entitled The Miami Connection. So with all that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Kelly Vlahos. Welcome back to Parallax Views, one of my favorite allies in the fight against the, it's been called the swamp, the deep state, the establishment. I just call it the DC hive mind at this point in the foreign policy blob. One of our best allies in that fight, Kelly Vlahos. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on again.
So we're going to be talking about a piece you wrote in Responsible Statecraft about the Miami-Haiti connection. But first, if you could, what do you make so far of all the craziness we're seeing with foreign policy right now? I mean, I think a lot of people are pressuring Biden with Afghanistan. We have the mayor of Miami saying we need airstrikes against Cuba. What do you make of all this craziness?
Yeah, I mean, it shows that it's kind of seeped right into our hemisphere, which is not so surprising, but it's very interesting. We spend so much of our time watching what's happening over in the Middle East and Afghanistan and Russia and beyond, and China, of course. And then suddenly this week, it seems like things are really ramping up in our own backyard. And it reminds us that, you know, we've had a long history of intervening and meddling and making things worse in this hemisphere, and chickens do come home to roost in ways that are unexpected.
So with regards to this latest piece you have in Responsible Statecraft, we just had the assassination of the Haitian president, and I don't want to botch his name. I think it's Moise, right?
I've heard Moise. Okay. I've heard both, so...
So
don't worry about botching.
What's the basic outline of the story so far, and what's the Miami connection to all this?
Sure. So I would have to say about a month or so ago, we published a piece in Responsible Statecraft, and probably longer than a month ago now, by Brian Concannon, who had talked about the ongoing protests in Haiti against Moise, basically saying that he had overstayed his welcome, his term in office. He had been ruling by decree with a dissolved parliament for over a year. And February 7th, he was supposed to be out, according to the terms of that decree, and he didn't leave. And so things were getting really restive. I was absolutely surprised that somebody shot him and killed him and wounded his wife. but the things that had been on a slow boil there for some time, and it's Haiti, and unfortunately things have been in disarray there, of tons of dysfunction in the government and corruption and violence in the streets. But anyway, so they find that there are a number of Colombian ex-military involved in this operation, in which they stormed his home and killed him in the middle of the night. They've tracked all of these Colombians to a security company, a private security firm in Miami, and further connected them to a expat, a doctor living in Florida, who wanted to replace Moise as president. And so all of, as of this recording, there is obviously an ongoing investigation in which they're piecing together all of these things. I found it very interesting that this private security company, which we know very little about, is connected to Venezuela. It's run by a Venezuelan expat, that Colombians were involved in the operation. The Colombians are saying that they really didn't know that they were on this operation to actually kill the president of Haiti. And there's some suggestion and rumors that there was actually, they were sort of like a, what do you call them, the patsies, and that there were real killers involved that are trying to shunt it off on these Colombians. This is all up in the air now. But the idea that there is this private security firm in Miami with connections to Colombia and Venezuela just reminded me of this story last year, 2020, in which a private security firm run by a former U.S. Navy SEAL had attempted a coup in Venezuela, training ex-Venezuelan military in Colombia.
What was known as the Bay of Piglets, right?
The Bay of Piglets, and everybody made fun of it. But the larger issue is, why do we have former Navy SEALs trying to get work as, not only bodyguards for, monarchs like, in the UAE, but people who are conducting coups and other military style campaigns in other countries. And as I wrote for Responsible Statecraft, that we're absolutely not going to be seeing the end of this very soon. I think our post 9/11 wars unleashed this privatization of warfare and war making, and unleashed veterans of our wars, whether it be our own military or other military that participated in these wars, onto the world, who are looking for work, and they see it as a lucrative business to hire themselves out.
With regards to the whole Bay of Piglets thing, it was a coup attempt against Maduro. What else do we know about that specific case?
Well, the sad case about that is, and what's sad, they asked for it, but there are two other former U.S. military that were in special forces who are involved, who were actually on the boats that went over there. There was a number of guys. I can't remember right now off the bat how many there were, but it was a tiny little operation. It started out to be in their minds, in conception, it was supposed to be hundreds of fighters were going to be going over there. One boat full of guys went over there. They were intercepted. They were arrested by the Venezuelan military. And among them were two American former Special Forces guys. And they were just convicted recently and are going to be spending decades in a Venezuelan jail, which I can imagine is not very pretty. And the guy that was heading this, his name is Jordan Goodreau, former Navy SEAL, is still in the United States somewhere. And he had been involved with another a Venezuelan ex-military who had opposed Maduro, and they concocted this scheme. They trained all of these soldiers in Colombia. There was a big AP story on this at the time with actual witnesses who had been at this camp, and they said it was really pathetic. They had weapons, but the scene there was that they were living in very Spartan ramshackle huts, and the overriding sentiment by the people who were interviewed for this had said, I don't know how these guys expect to get anything done. This is a really stupid plan. And it turned out to be true. And it just kind of left this Jordan Gaudreau character with a lot of egg on his face, even though he had apparently a stellar record as a Navy SEAL, but he had started this, you know, private security company called Silver Corps in the United States, in Florida, and thought that he, you know, he had his eyes on much bigger jobs than just, you know, being a bodyguard or providing security for companies and governments. They went all out, and they intimated that they actually had buy-in from Guaido, the opposition. Juan Guaido, who is the opposition leader in Venezuela, hasn't been very successful in his opposition plans. But they had suggested, Gaudreau and his Venezuelan partner, that they actually had worked with Guaido on this coup plan. Guaido has adamantly denied that he had anything to do with it. But I guess the end game was deposing Maduro and initiating the presidency of Juan Guaido, which was actually U.S. policy under Trump, was a regime change in Venezuela. But I think the chances for that happening now are pretty slim. Maduro has proven himself pretty durable in his role there.
I was going to say, it's interesting too, because I mean, you have two former Green Berets in that case convicted on charges of conspiracy, illicit trafficking of weapons, and terrorism. What's really wild to me though is, as you point out in the article, I mean, guns for hire have always been a thing, but it seems like the mercenary private army phenomena explodes after 9/11. Just give my listeners a brief sketch, if you could, of what happens after 9/11 that causes this explosion. I know the short answer is the war on terror, but how does it all sort of come together?
Well, I think it all comes together because the U.S. supported this throughout the war on terror. So in unprecedented numbers, the United States privatized its wars. And so you had at one point at the peak in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, we're talking the years 2008, 2009, 2010, you had more contractors in these countries than you had U.S. service members. And they are doing everything from, food service to, breaking down trash in the burn pits to building and constructing barracks to security for our diplomats going over there, intelligence, interrogation, IT. So we're talking a wide band of services that go from the real banal to all the way up to real like covert stuff like Blackwater assisting the CIA in Pakistan, which Jeremy Scahill had reported on many years ago, a CIA, of course, denied. But that's, you know, there was a lot going on there. And so we're talking about tens of thousands, if not millions, over the 20-year period of contractors going in there and getting paid heartily for it, sometimes more than our own service members. Now, I'll caveat that by saying that when they did die or get hurt or had to get sent home with lifelong injuries, they didn't have the health care that our troops had. So in some ways, it was sort of waging war on the cheap. You know, we pay a lot on the front end for these contractors so we wouldn't have to, A, be responsible for them when they got hurt. And it wasn't as obvious that we were waging this war with so many numbers because, frankly, Americans don't care about contractors. So it's an easy way to put a lot of bodies in a war without being sort of responsible for the optics and the accountability for them. So they fly under the radar. And right.
So then I was just going to add, so then, you know, if they're waging, you know, an insurgency or repressing local populations or assassinating the leader of another country, you know, the optics are a bit different when you have these contractors doing it.
Right. And that's, and so that, that's a big draw after the war. So, so one hand you have the ethos of privatization had been made more official, more normalized by the wars on terror, by the war on terror. And now you have a relatively huge pool of not only veterans, but all of these contractors floating around looking for things to do, how to maintain a career, how to advance a career after the wars. What do? You go into the private security business. You see somebody like Eric Prince, who's been relatively successful over the years and getting all sorts of government contracts, not only from the United States, but from all these other countries in the Middle East and in Africa and China now. And you say, hey, I want a piece of that. So I feel like that's how the 9/11 wars sort of proliferated this. And I mean, let's be frank. I mean, guns for hire have been around for centuries. This isn't a new phenomenon. My point is that it's always been there, and that our wars actually opened up new opportunities, new doors on an unprecedented level, quickly, fast. And now in an environment where countries, whether it be the United States or Russia or North Africa or whatever, want to engage in warfare on the cheap and out of the of public scrutiny. And this is how they do it. They hire private mercenaries to do it.
I found it interesting. You used the metaphor of the legend of the djinn or the genie. And I know both you and Michael Vlahos are fond of this sort of djinn as a metaphor. Why is that a good metaphor in this case?
Well, I think it's a metaphor, and I can't take credit for it, because Sean McFate, who has written quite extensively on the new era, the future of warfare and the mercenary and private, war making, however you want to put it, has written extensively. And he used this idea that you can't, we unleash this genie during our 9/11 wars, and there's no way of getting him back, or that genie back into the bottle. So I like to say that, because I think that it is a sort of a succinct visual for what we did. And for a lot of things that the United States does in foreign policy, we unleash something because of its political convenience, its strategic value at the time. Another thing that I like to correlate with this is the drone wars. We had built through our military industrial complex the most advanced armed drone industry ever. And now we see, whether it be Turkey or the Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, the use of drone warfare is bubbling up, with insurgents and governments alike being able to build their own technology, but patterned off of this this operational invention or innovation that we first came up with 20 years ago. And so I like to talk about how, we unleash these djinns or these genies, and then we lament when we see that they're being used and abused by other powers and malign actors, so to speak. And that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing that our use of private mercenaries in our wars is coming back to haunt us in ways that we might not have anticipated, because now we see the Wagner Group being associated with the Russian government. We see our own military selling their services to China, for example, under Eric Prince's new outfit. So, we can't complain.
So before we close out, for me, this issue of, private mercenary armies, that's essentially what they are. I don't see this as a left or a right issue. I think you could be a conservative, a libertarian, a progressive, a Bernie guy, and be concerned about this. Where do you stand on that? I think this transcends that sort of left-right divide.
I certainly do. And, you know, I'll say right now, Sean McVay is not a Democrat or a Republican. He's a military guy who actually worked in the private sector after getting out of the military. So he knows it firsthand. And I think the concern is not partisan. The concern is, an American taxpayer concern, because your money, my money, our children are going to fight wars that are increasingly running under the radar because they are being privatized in ways that there is no accountability for how that money is spent, for how our blood and treasure is spilled in these wars. And so on the other hand, we have both Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill who have supported these policies all through the war, because, you know, and I'm not putting any words in anybody's mouth, but I would imagine there are plenty of Democrats who saw that, you know, sending contractors over there was to them more politically palatable than putting more troops on the ground, for example. And they could say, well, we have fewer men and women in our armed services dying for these causes or in harm's way. But there's still Americans going over there. Now, you know, after all that, many of the contractors that are commissioned through the American government are third-party nationals and aren't Americans. So I guess these Democrats could say, well, you know, they're not Americans that are dying over there. We're hiring these people, we're giving them jobs, and they're doing their thing. And Republicans would probably say the same thing, that this is a cheaper, more efficient, open market way of waging war. And so I don't see that as partisan. I do see it it's an American obligation to hold the government accountable for what it's unleashed here. And in Afghanistan, for example, you know, we talk about the withdrawal. We're withdrawing, you know, 3,500 troops from that country. But as I point out in my article, there are, I think, I want to say 17,000, 18,000 contractors over there, 6,000 of which are American. The rest of them are Afghan and other countries who have been working directly on the American payroll. What's going to happen to the contracting situation in Afghanistan? Some stories have indicated that they're coming home along with our men and women in the armed services. Other stories have talked about how there are a bunch of companies who have put out bids and are posting jobs for positions in Afghanistan after we leave. Now, presumably that's because the poor Afghans military can't run their aircraft and their maintenance needs without assistance. And so they're going to need contractors to serve as mechanics and trainers and all that stuff. But I don't know. Are there going to be private security contractors over there? We don't know. So that's something to look at in the news today.
So closing out here, I think the other big aspect of this is, I mean, does any of this really make us any safer?
No, I don't think it makes us any safer, because when we are using our own men and women, our own military to pursue policy, military, national security, foreign policy overseas, there is some sense of accountability. We know what's happening. On the most part, that's a whole other show in terms of what we know. But take that down another level, where the Pentagon is hiring out private military contractors to do its work overseas. That level of scrutiny goes down, and it's further cloaked. And so we won't know until something really bad happens what these people were doing in our name overseas. And then bring in the foreign perspective where you have other countries hiring private security contractors to do dirty work. And I will, you know, I keep referring back to Eric Prince, but he has been cited by the UN for violating arms embargoes in Libya because he may or may not be, I'm trying to be careful because he's denied it, connected to a plot to support the General Haftar over there, who is trying to depose the government in that massive civil war going on there. So, I mean, so we have private mercenaries working for governments and insurgents, you know, to destabilize areas of the country, of the world, whether it be, you know, in Libya or in Haiti, you know, and elsewhere. And so, yeah, it's a bad thing. And it's in a completely unregulated industry. And there's no way that the United States is going to step in and start like regulating private military contractors and companies. It's not going to happen. And so, so anything goes at this point.
And I just wanted to add one last thing. And then I promise to let you go because I know we had to keep this episode short. But, you know, I have a pretty broad range of listeners. A lot of them are progressives and Bernie-crats and whatnot. But I have like sort of dissident conservatives and libertarians too. And I think a lot of times people on the maybe conservative or libertarian end of the spectrum will hear privatization and say, oh, well, that sounds great. But I mean, ultimately these, you know, private contractors, they're in an unholy alliance with the state.
Right. It's crony capitalism at its most extreme, because we're talking about warfare and we're talking about, and specifically the 9/11 wars, where billions of dollars were handed over to companies like Halliburton with its KBR subsidiary. And then Halliburton turns around and overcharges the government, engages in waste and fraud and abuse, cut corners, did everything to abuse the privilege. So that's not real capitalism. That's not open markets. It is one company that played a monopolistic role, and our 9/11 wars got all of our tax dollars. I mean, there were in many cases, no bid fashion. Like they didn't have to compete and then turned around and screwed us. And so I don't find that particularly conservative or libertarian, because like you said, it's an unholy alliance between the government and the corporation. And it resulted in not only a screwing of the taxpayers, but real shoddy work and services for our troops in the field. And the best example I always use is KBR building these barracks and, basically cutting so many corners when they were running the electricity through there that we had troops who were electrocuted when they were taking showers. And anybody can just look that up really quick. That is the best example that I have come across of crony capitalism becoming deadly in the field for our troops. And I find that egregious because you and I are paying for that. And if I'm going to pay for a war, I want to make sure at the very least that our men and women aren't getting electrocuted in showers.
Well, Kelly, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. And I want to echo the sentiment at the end of your article at Responsible Statecraft. Let's hope Eric Prince doesn't have his fingerprints on this assassination in Haiti. You think that's possible? Or
I mean, it's of course it's possible. I mean, I don't want to like break any news or spread any rumors. But when you look at Eric Prince's record, he has been in no fewer than like I would say four continents operating China, Africa, the Middle East, the United States, and beyond. I am probably missing something very obvious in this conversation, but this guy has been basically prancing around the world, selling his services, have gone, will travel, and obviously South America. So, I mean, it's not, a lot of his little ventures have failed or have been aborted at the last minute. This one actually was successful in that somebody was killed. So maybe his fingerprints aren't on this one. This is turning into a very sad conversation, actually. But yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Well, how can my listeners keep up with your work and anything else you want to add?
I'm glad that you're doing a show on the contracting issue, because I think it's really important as we are nearing the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. I believe personally, this is one of the most important and possibly destructive outgrowths of 9/11 and the impact on the military and the contracting industry, and where it goes from here, no one knows, but it's definitely something to watch.
And people can keep up with your work at Responsible Statecraft, and also you're on Twitter. I think you have two Twitter accounts, right?
Yeah, I have my Quincy one, which is Vlahos at Quincy, and then my more personal handle, which is Kelly B. Vlahos.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kelly Vlahos of the Quincy Institute's Responsible Statecraft publication. We love the Quincy Institute here at Parallax Views. And of course, Kelly is one of our best allies in fighting the DC foreign policy blob. A very astute commentator and reporter on all things related to U.S. foreign policy. Her work comes highly recommended by yours truly. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.